Keep the Aspidistra Flying by George Orwell. Chapter 3. Gordon Comstock was a pretty bloody name. But then Gordon came of a pretty bloody family. The Gordon part of it was Scotch, of course. The prevalence of such names nowadays is merely a part of this Scotchification of England that has been going on these last 50 years. Gordon, Colin, Malcolm, Donald. These are the gifts of Scotland to the world, along with golf, whisky, porridge, and the works of Barry and Stevenson. The Comstocks belong to the most dismal of all classes, the middle class, the landless gentry. In their miserable poverty, they had not even the snobbish consolation of regarding themselves as an old family fallen on evil days, for they were not an old family at all, merely one of those families which rose on the wave of Victorian prosperity and then sank again faster than the wave itself. They had had at most 50 years of comparative wealth, corresponding with the lifetime of Gordon's grandfather, Samuel Comstock. Grandpa Comstock, as Gordon was taught to call him, though the old man died 4 years before he was born. Grandpa Comstock was one of those people who even from the grave exert a powerful influence. In life he was a tough old scoundrel. He plundered the proletariat and the foreigner of £50,000. He built himself a red brick mansion as durable as a pyramid, and he begot 12 children, of whom 11 survived. Finally, he died quite suddenly of a cerebral hemorrhage. In Kensal Green, his children placed over him a monolith with the following inscription: "In ever-loving memory of Samuel Ezekiel Comstock, a faithful husband, a tender father, and an upright and godly man, who was born on July the 9th, 1828, and departed this life September the 5th, 1901. This stone is erected by his sorrowing children. He sleeps in the arms of Jesus." No need to repeat the blasphemous comments which everyone who had known Grandpa Comstock made on that last sentence, but it is worth pointing out that the chunk of granite on which it was inscribed weighed close on 5 tons, and was quite certainly put there with the intention, though not the conscious intention, of making sure that Grandpa Comstock shouldn't get up from underneath it. If you want to know what a dead man's relatives really think of him, a good rough test is the weight of his tombstone. The Comstocks, as Gordon knew them, were a peculiarly dull, shabby, dead-alive, ineffectual family. They lacked vitality to an extent that was surprising. That was Grandpa Comstock's doing, of course. By the time when he died, all his children were grown up, and some of them were middle-aged, and he had long ago succeeded in crushing out of them any spirit they might ever have possessed. He had lain upon them as a garden roller lies upon daisies, and there was no chance of their flattened personalities ever expanding again. One and all, they turned out listless, gutless, unsuccessful sort of people. None of the boys had proper professions, because Grandpa Comstock had been at the greatest pains to drive all of them into professions for which they were totally unsuited. Only one of them, John, Gordon's father, had even braved Grandpa Comstock to the extent of getting married during the latter's lifetime. It was impossible to imagine any of them making any sort of mark in the world, or creating anything, or destroying anything, or being happy, or vividly unhappy, or fully alive, or even earning a decent income. They just drifted along in an atmosphere of semi-genteel failure. They were one of those depressing families so common among the middle classes in which nothing ever happens. From his earliest childhood, Gordon's relatives had depressed him horribly. When he was a little boy, he still had great numbers of uncles and aunts living. They were all more or less alike, grey, shabby, joyless people, all rather sickly in health, and all perpetually harassed by money worries which fizzled along without ever reaching the sensational explosion of bankruptcy. It was notable even then that they had lost all impulse to reproduce themselves. Really vital people whether they have money or whether they haven't, multiply almost as automatically as animals. Grandpa Comstock, for instance, himself one of a litter of 12, had produced 11 progeny. Yet all those 11 produced only 2 progeny between them, and those 2, Gordon and his sister Julia, had produced by 1934 not even 1. Gordon, last of the Comstocks, was born in 1905, an unintended child. And thereafter, in 30 long, long years, there was not a single birth in the family, only deaths. And not only in the matter of marrying and begetting, but in every possible way, nothing ever happened in the Comstock family. Every one of them seemed doomed, as though by a curse, to a dismal, shabby, hole-and-corner existence. None of them ever did anything. They were the kind of people who, in every conceivable activity, even if it is only getting onto a bus, are automatically elbowed away from the heart of things. All of them, of course, were hopeless fools about money. Grandpa Comstock had finally divided his money among them more or less equally, so that each received, after the sale of the red brick mansion, round about £5,000. And no sooner was Grandpa Comstock underground than they began to fritter their money away. None of them had the guts to lose it in sensational ways such as squandering it on women or at the races. They simply dribbled it away and dribbled it away, the women in silly investments and the men in futile little business ventures that petered out after a year or two, leaving a net loss. More than half of them went unmarried to their graves. Some of the women did make rather undesirable middle-aged marriages after their father was dead, but the men, because of their incapacity to earn a proper living, were the kind who can't afford to marry. None of them, except Gordon's Aunt Angela, ever had so much as a home to call their own. They were the kind of people who live in godless rooms and tomb-like boarding houses. And year after year they died off and died off of dingy but expensive little diseases that swallowed up the last penny of their capital. One of the women, Gordon's Aunt Charlotte, wandered off into the mental home at Clapham in 1916. The mental homes of England, how chock-a-block they stand. And it is, above all, derelict spinsters of the middle classes who keep them going. By 1934, only 3 of that generation survived. Aunt Charlotte, already mentioned, and Aunt Angela, who by some happy chance had been induced to buy a house and a tiny annuity in 1912, and Uncle Walter, who dingily existed on the few £100 that were left out of his 5,000, and by running short-lived agencies for this and that. Gordon grew up in the atmosphere of cut-down clothes and stewed neck of mutton. His father, like the other Comstocks, was a depressed and therefore depressing person, but he had some brains and a slight literary turn. And seeing that his mind was of the literary type, and he had a shrinking horror of anything to do with figures, it had seemed only natural to Grandpa Comstock to make him into a chartered accountant. So he practised, ineffectually, as a chartered accountant, and was always buying his way into partnerships which were dissolved after a year or two, and his income fluctuated, sometimes rising to 500 a year, and sometimes falling to 200, but always with a tendency to decrease. He died in 1922, aged only 56, but worn out. He had suffered from a kidney disease for a long time past. Since the Comstocks were genteel as well as shabby, it was considered necessary to waste huge sums on Gordon's education. What a fearful thing it is, this incubus of education. It means that in order to send his son to the right kind of school, that is, a public school or an imitation of one, a middle-class man is obliged to live for years on end in a style that would be scorned by a jobbing plumber. Gordon was sent to wretched, pretentious schools whose fees were round about £120 a year. Even these fees, of course, meant fearful sacrifices at home. Meanwhile, Julia, who was 5 years older than he, received, as nearly as possible, no education at all. She was, indeed, sent to one or two poor, dingy little boarding schools, but she was taken away for good when she was 16. Gordon was the boy, and Julia was the girl, and it seemed natural to everyone that the girl should be sacrificed to the boy. Moreover, it had early been decided in the family that Gordon was clever. Gordon, with his wonderful cleverness, was to win scholarships, make a brilliant success in life, and retrieve the family fortunes. That was the theory, and no one believed in it more firmly than Julia. Julia was a tall, ungainly girl, much taller than Gordon, with a thin face and a neck just a little too long, one of those girls who, even at their most youthful, remind one irresistibly of a goose. But her nature was simple and affectionate. She was a self-effacing, home-keeping, ironing, darning, and mending kind of girl, a natural spinster soul. Even at 16 she had old maid written all over her. She idolized Gordon. All through his childhood she watched over him, nursed him, spoiled him, went in rags so that he might have the right clothes to go to school in, saved up her wretched pocket money to buy him Christmas presents and birthday presents, and of course he repaid her as soon as he was old enough by despising her because she was not pretty and not clever. Even at the third-rate schools to which Gordon was sent, nearly all the boys were richer than himself. They soon found out his poverty, of course, and gave him hell because of it. Probably the greatest cruelty one can inflict on a child is to send it to school among children richer than itself. A child conscious of poverty will suffer snobbish agonies such as a grown-up person can scarcely even imagine. In those days, especially at his preparatory school, Gordon's life had been one long conspiracy to keep his end up and pretend that his parents were richer than they were. Oh, the humiliations of those days. That awful business, for instance, at the beginning of each term, when you had to give in to the headmaster, publicly, the money you had brought back with you, and the contemptuous, cruel sniggers from the other boys when you didn't give in 10 bob or more. And the time when the others found out that Gordon was wearing a ready-made suit which had cost 35 shillings. The times that Gordon dreaded most of all were when his parents came down to see him. Gordon, in those days still a believer, used actually to pray that his parents wouldn't come down to school. His father especially was the kind of father you couldn't help being ashamed of. A cadaverous, despondent man with a bad stoop, his clothes dismally shabby and hopelessly out of date. He carried about with him an atmosphere of failure, worry, and boredom. And he had such a dreadful habit when he was saying goodbye of tipping Gordon half a crown right in front of the other boys so that everyone could see that it was only half a crown and not, as it ought to have been, 10 bob. Even 20 years afterwards, the memory of that school made Gordon shudder. The first effect of all this was to give him a crawling reverence for money. In those days he actually hated his poverty-stricken relatives, his father and mother, Julia, everybody. He hated them for their dingy homes, their dowdiness, their joyless attitude to life, their endless worrying and groaning over threepences and sixpences. By far the commonest phrase in the Comstock household was, "We can't afford it." In those days he longed for money as only a child can long. Why shouldn't one have decent clothes and plenty of sweets and go to the pictures as often as one wanted to? He blamed his parents for their poverty as though they had been poor on purpose. Why couldn't they be like other boys' parents? They preferred being poor, it seemed to him. That's how a child's mind works. But as he grew older, he grew not less unreasonable exactly, but unreasonable in a different way. By this time he had found his feet at school and was less violently oppressed. He was never very successful at school. He did no work and won no scholarships, but he managed to develop his brain along the lines that suited it. He read the books which the headmaster denounced from the pulpit, and developed unorthodox opinions about the C of E, patriotism, and the old boy's tie. Also, he began writing poetry. He even, after a year or two, began to send poems to the Athenaeum, the New Age, and the Weekly Westminster. but they were invariably rejected. Of course, there were other boys of similar type with whom he associated. Every public school has its small, self-conscious intelligentsia. And at that moment, in the years just after the war, England was so full of revolutionary opinion that even the public schools were infected by it. The young, even those who had been too young to fight, were in a bad temper with their elders, as well they might be. Practically everyone with any brains at all was, for the moment, a revolutionary. Meanwhile, the old, those over 60, say, were running in circles like hens, squawking about subversive ideas. Gordon and his friends had quite an exciting time with their subversive ideas. For a whole year, they ran an unofficial monthly paper called The Bolshevik, duplicated with a jellygraph. It advocated socialism, free love, the dismemberment of the British Empire, the abolition of the army and navy, and so on and so forth. It was great fun. Every intelligent boy of 16 is a socialist. At that age, one does not see the hook sticking out of the rather stodgy bait. In a crude, boyish way, he had begun to get the hang of this money business. At an earlier age than most people, he grasped that all modern commerce is a swindle. Curiously enough, it was the advertisements in the underground stations that first brought it home to him. He little knew, as the biographers say, that he himself would one day have a job in an advertising firm. But there was more to it than the mere fact that business is a swindle. What he realized, and more clearly as time went on, was that money worship has been elevated into a religion. Perhaps it is the only real religion, the only really felt religion, that is left to us. Money is what God used to be. Good and evil have no meaning any longer except failure and success. Hence the profoundly significant phrase, to make good. The Decalogue has been reduced to two commandments. One for the employers, the elect, the money priesthood, as it were, thou shalt make money. The other for the employed, the slaves and underlings, thou shalt not lose thy job. It was about this time that he came across the ragged-trousered philanthropists and read about the starving carpenter who pawns everything but sticks to his aspidistra. The aspidistra became a sort of symbol for Gordon after that. The aspidistra. Flower of England. It ought to be on our coat of arms instead of the lion and the unicorn. There will be no revolution in England while there are aspidistras in the windows. He did not hate and despise his relatives now, or not so much at any rate. They still depressed him greatly, those poor old withering aunts and uncles, of whom two or three had already died. His father, worn out and spiritless. His mother, faded, nervy and delicate, her lungs were none too strong. Julia, already at 21, a dutiful, resigned drudge who worked 12 hours a day and never had a decent frock. But he grasped now what was the matter with them. It was not merely the lack of money. It was rather that, having no money, they still lived mentally in the money world, the world in which money is virtue and poverty is crime. It was not poverty, but the down-dragging of respectable poverty that had done for them. They had accepted the money code, and by that code they were failures. They had never had the sense to lash out and just live, money or no money, as the lower classes do. How right the lower classes are. Hats off to the factory lad who, with fourpence in the world, puts his girl in the family way. At least he's got blood and not money in his veins. Gordon thought it all out in the naive, selfish manner of a boy. There are two ways to live, he decided. You can be rich, or you can deliberately refuse to be rich. You can possess money, or you can despise money. The one fatal thing is to worship money and fail to get it. He took it for granted that he himself would never be able to make money. It hardly even occurred to him that he might have talents which could be turned to account. That was what his schoolmasters had done for him. They had rubbed it into him that he was a seditious little nuisance and not likely to succeed in life. He accepted this. Very well, then, he would refuse the whole business of succeeding. He would make it his especial purpose not to succeed. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. Better to serve in hell than serve in heaven, for that matter. Already at 16, he knew which side he was on. He was against the money god and all his swinish priesthood. He had declared war on money, but secretly, of course. It was when he was 17 that his father died, leaving about £200. Julia had been at work for some years now. During 1918 and 1919, she had worked in a government office, and after that she took a course of cookery and got a job in a nasty, ladylike little tea shop near Earl's Court Underground Station. She worked a 72-hour week and was given her lunch and tea and 25 shillings. Out of this, she contributed 12 shillings a week, often more, to the household expenses. Obviously, the best thing to do, now that Mr. Comstock was dead, would have been to take Gordon away from school, find him a job, and let Julia have the £200 to set up a tea shop of her own. But here the habitual Comstock folly about money stepped in. Neither Julia nor her mother would hear of Gordon leaving school. With the strange idealistic snobbishness of the middle classes, they were willing to go to the workhouse sooner than let Gordon leave school before the statutory age of 18. The £200, or more than half of it, must be used in completing Gordon's education. Gordon let them do it. He had declared war on money, but that did not prevent him from being damnably selfish. Of course, he dreaded this business of going to work. What boy wouldn't dread it? Pen pushing in some filthy office? God! His uncles and aunts were already talking dismally about getting Gordon settled in life. They saw everything in terms of good jobs. Young Smith had got such a good job in a bank, and young Jones had got such a good job in an insurance office. It made him sick to hear them. They seemed to want to see every young man in England nailed down in the coffin of a good job. Meanwhile, money had got to be earned. Before her marriage, Gordon's mother had been a music teacher, and ever since then she had taken pupils sporadically when the family were in lower water than usual. She now decided that she would start giving lessons again. It was fairly easy to get pupils in the suburbs. They were living in Acton, and with the music fees and Julia's contribution, they could probably manage for the next year or two. But the state of Mrs. Comstock's lungs was now something more than delicate. The doctor who had attended her husband before his death had put his stethoscope to her chest and looked serious. He had told her to take care of herself, keep warm, eat nourishing food, and above all, avoid fatigue. The fidgeting, tiring job of giving piano lessons was, of course, the worst possible thing for her. Gordon knew nothing of this. Julia knew, however. It was a secret between the two women, carefully kept from Gordon. A year went by. Gordon spent it rather miserably, more and more embarrassed by his shabby clothes and lack of pocket money, which made girls an object of terror to him. However, the New Age accepted one of his poems that year. Meanwhile, his mother sat on comfortless piano stools in draughty drawing rooms, giving lessons at 2 shillings an hour. And then Gordon left school, and fat, interfering Uncle Walter, who had business connections in a small way, came forward and said that a friend of his could get Gordon ever such a good job in the accounts department of a red lead firm. It was really a splendid job, a wonderful opening for a young man. If Gordon buckled to work in the right spirit, he might be a big pot one of these days. Gordon's soul squirmed. Suddenly, as weak people do, he stiffened, and to the horror of the whole family, refused even to try for the job. There were fearful rows, of course. They could not understand him. It seemed to them a kind of blasphemy to refuse such a good job when you got the chance of it. He kept reiterating that he didn't want that kind of job. Then what did he want? They all demanded. He wanted to write, he told them sullenly. But how could he possibly make a living by writing? They demanded again, and of course he couldn't answer. At the back of his mind was the idea that he could somehow live by writing poetry, but that was too absurd even to be mentioned. But at any rate, he wasn't going into business, into the money world. He would have a job, but not a good job. None of them had the vaguest idea what he meant. His mother wept. Even Julia went for him, And all around him there were uncles and aunts, he still had six or seven of them left, feebly volleying and incompetently thundering. And after 3 days, a dreadful thing happened. In the middle of supper, his mother was seized by a violent fit of coughing, put her hand to her breast, fell forward, and began bleeding at the mouth. Gordon was terrified. His mother did not die, as it happened, but she looked deathly as they carried her upstairs. Gordon rushed for the doctor. For several days his mother lay at death's door. It was the draughty drawing rooms and the trudging to and fro in all weathers that had done it. Gordon hung helplessly about the house, a dreadful feeling of guilt mingling with his misery. He did not exactly know, but he half divined that his mother had killed herself in order to pay his school fees. After this, he could not go on opposing her any longer. He went to Uncle Walter and told him that he would take that job in the Red Lead firm if they would give it to him. So Uncle Walter spoke to his friend, and the friend spoke to his friend, and Gordon was sent for and interviewed by an old gentleman with badly fitting false teeth, and finally was given a job on probation. He started on 25 bob a week, and with this firm he remained 6 years. They moved away from Acton and took a flat in a desolate red block of flats somewhere in the Paddington district. Mrs. Comstock had brought her piano, and when she had got some of her strength back, she gave occasional lessons. Gordon's wages were gradually raised, and the three of them managed, more or less. It was Julia and Mrs. Comstock who did most of the managing. Gordon still had a boy's selfishness about money. At the office, he got on not absolutely badly. It was said of him that he was worth his wages, but wasn't the type that makes good. In a way, the utter contempt that he had for his work made things easier for him. He could put up with this meaningless office life because he never for an instant thought of it as permanent. Somehow, sometime, God knew how or when, he was going to break free of it. After all, there was always his writing. Some day, perhaps, he might be able to make a living of sorts by writing, and you'd feel you were free of the money stink if you were a writer, would you not? The types he saw all around him, especially the older men, made him squirm. That was what it meant to worship the money god, to settle down, to make good, to sell your soul for a villa and an aspidistra, to turn into the typical little bowler-hatted sneak. Stroob's little man, the little docile cit who slips home by the 6:15 to a supper of cottage pie and stewed tin pears, half an hour's listening in to the BBC symphony concert, and then perhaps a spot of licit sexual intercourse if his wife feels in the mood. What a fate. No, it isn't like that that one was meant to live. One's got to get right out of it, out of the money stink. It was a kind of plot that he was nursing. He was as though dedicated to this war against money, but it was still a secret. The people at the office never suspected him of unorthodox ideas. They never even found out that he wrote poetry. Not that there was much to find out, for in 6 years he had less than 20 poems printed in the magazines. To look at, he was just the same as any other city clerk, just a soldier in the strap-hanging army that sways eastward at morning, westward at night, in the carriages of the underground. He was 24 when his mother died. The family was breaking up. Only 4 of the older generation of Comstocks were left now, Aunt Angela, Aunt Charlotte, Uncle Walter, and another uncle who died a year later. Gordon and Julia gave up the flat. Gordon took a furnished room in Doughty Street. He felt it vaguely literary, living in Bloomsbury, and Julia moved to Earl's Court to be near the shop. Julia was nearly 30 now and looked much older. She was thinner than ever, though healthy enough, and there was grey in her hair. She still worked 12 hours a day, and in 6 years her wages had only risen by 10 shillings a week. The horribly ladylike lady who kept the tea shop was a semi-friend, as well as an employer, and thus could sweat and bully Julia to the tune of dearest and darling. 4 months after his mother's death, Gordon suddenly walked out of his job. He gave the firm no reasons. They imagined that he was going to better himself, and luckily, as it turned out, gave him quite good references. He'd not even thought of looking for another job. He wanted to burn his boats. From now on, he would breathe free air, free of the money stink. He had not consciously waited for his mother to die before doing this. Still, it was his mother's death that had nerved him to it. Of course, there was another and more desolating row in what was left of the family. They thought Gordon must have gone mad. Over and over again, he tried, quite vainly, to explain to them why he would not yield himself to the servitude of a good job. "But what are you going to live on? What are you going to live on?" was what they all wailed at him. He refused to think seriously about it. Of course, he still harboured the notion that he could make a living of sorts by writing. By this time, he had got to know Ravelston, editor of Antichrist, and Ravelston, besides printing his poems, managed to get him books to review occasionally. His literary prospects were not so bleak as they had been 6 years ago, but still, it was not the desire to write that was his real motive, to get out of the money world. That was what he wanted. Vaguely, he looked forward to some kind of moneyless, anchorite existence. He had a feeling that if you genuinely despise money, you can keep going somehow like the birds of the air. He forgot that the birds of the air don't pay room rent. The poet, starving in a garret, but starving somehow not uncomfortably, that was his vision of himself. The next 7 months were devastating. They scared him and almost broke his spirit. He learned what it means to live for weeks on end on bread and margarine, to try to write when you were half-starved, to pawn your clothes, to sneak trembling up the stairs when you owe 3 weeks' rent and your landlady is listening for you. Moreover, in those 7 months he wrote practically nothing. The first effect of poverty is that it kills thought. He grasped, as though it were a new discovery, that you do not escape from money merely by being moneyless. On the contrary, you are the hopeless slave of money until you have enough of it to live on. A competence, as the beastly middle-class phrase goes. Finally, he was turned out of his room after a vulgar row. He was 3 days and 4 nights in the street. It was bloody. 3 mornings, on the advice of another man he met on the embankment, he spent in Billingsgate, helping to shove fish barrows up the twisted little hills from Billingsgate into Eastcheap. Tuppence and up was what you got, and the work knocked hell out of your thigh muscles. There were crowds of people on the same job, and you had to wait your turn. You were lucky if you made 18 pence between 4 in the morning and 9. After 3 days of it, Gordon gave up. What was the use? He was beaten. There was nothing for it but to go back to his family, borrow some money, and find another job. But now, of course, there was no job to be had. For months, he lived by cadging on the family. Julia kept him going till the last penny of her tiny savings was gone. It was abominable. Here was the outcome of all his fine attitudes. He had renounced ambition, made war on money, and all it led to was cadging from his sister. And Julia, he knew, felt his failure far more than she felt the loss of her savings. She had had such hopes of Gordon. He alone of all the Comstocks had had it in him to succeed. Even now she believed that somehow, some day, he was going to retrieve the family fortunes. He was so clever. Surely he could make money if he tried. For 2 whole months Gordon stayed with Aunt Angela in her little house at Highgate. Poor, faded, mummified Aunt Angela, who even for herself had barely enough to eat. All this time he searched desperately for work. Uncle Walter could not help him. His influence in the business world, never large, was now practically nil. At last, however, in a quite unexpected way, the luck turned. A friend of a friend of Julia's employer's brother managed to get Gordon a job in the accounts department of the New Albion Publicity Company. The New Albion was one of those publicity firms which have sprung up everywhere since the war, the fungi, as you might say, that sprout from a decaying capitalism. It was a smallish, rising firm, and took every class of publicity it could get. It designed a certain number of large-scale posters for oatmeal stout, self-raising flour and so forth, but its main line was millinery and cosmetic advertisements in the women's illustrated papers, besides minor ads in the Tuppenny Weeklies such as White Rose Pills for Female Disorders, Your Horoscope Cast by Professor Rarotongo, The Seven Secrets of Venus, The Truth About Bad Legs, Drink Habit Conquered in 3 Days, and Cyprolax Hair Lotion Banishes All Unpleasant Intruders. There was a large staff of commercial artists, of course. It was here that Gordon first made the acquaintance of Rosemary. She was in the studio and helped to design fashion plates. It was a long time before he actually spoke to her. At first, he knew her merely as a remote personage, small, dark, with swift movements, distinctly attractive, but rather intimidating. When they passed one another in the corridors, she eyed him ironically, as though she knew all about him, and considered him a bit of a joke. Nevertheless, she seemed to look at him a little oftener than was necessary. He had nothing to do with her side of the business. He was in the accounts department, a mere clerk on 3 quid a week. The interesting thing about the New Albion was that it was so completely modern in spirit. There was hardly a soul in the firm who was not perfectly well aware that publicity, advertising, is the dirtiest ramp that capitalism has yet produced. In the Red Lead firm, there had still lingered certain notions of commercial honour and usefulness, but such things would have been laughed at in the New Albion. Most of the employees were the hard-boiled, Americanized, go-getting type, the type to whom nothing in the world is sacred, except money. They had their cynical code worked out. The public are swine. Advertising is the rattling of a stick inside a swill bucket. And yet beneath their cynicism, there was the final naivete, the blind worship of the money god. Gordon studied them unobtrusively. As before, he did his work passably well, and his fellow employees looked down on him. Nothing had changed in his inner mind. He still despised and repudiated the money code. Somehow, sooner or later, he was going to escape from it. Even now, after his late fiasco, he still plotted escape. He was in the money world, but not of it. As for the types about him, the little bowler-hatted worms who never turned, and the go-getters, the American Business College gutter crawlers, they rather amused him than not. He liked studying their slavish keep-your-job mentality. He was the child among them, taking notes. One day, a curious thing happened. Somebody chanced to see a poem of Gordon's in a magazine, and put it about that they had a poet in the office. Of course, Gordon was laughed at, not ill-naturedly, by the other clerks. They nicknamed him the Bard from that day forth, but though amused, they were also faintly contemptuous. It confirmed all their ideas about Gordon. A fellow who wrote poetry wasn't exactly the type to make good. But the thing had an unexpected sequel. About the time when the clerks grew tired of chaffing Gordon, Mr. Erskine, the managing director, who had hitherto taken only the minimum notice of him, suddenly sent for him and interviewed him. Mr. Erskine was a large, slow-moving man with a broad, healthy, expressionless face. From his appearance and the slowness of his speech, you would have guessed with confidence that he had something to do with either agriculture or cattle breeding. His wits were as slow as his movements, and he was the kind of man who never hears of anything until everybody else has stopped talking about it. How such a man came to be in charge of an advertising agency, only the strange gods of capitalism know. But he was quite a likable person. He had not that sniffish, buttoned-up spirit that usually goes with an ability to make money, and in a way his fat-wittedness stood him in good stead. Being insensible to popular prejudice, he could assess people on their merits. Consequently, he was rather good at choosing talented employees. The news that Gordon had written poems, so far from shocking him, vaguely impressed him. They wanted literary talent in the New Albion. Having sent for Gordon, he studied him in a somnolent, sidelong way and asked him a number of inconclusive questions. He never listened to Gordon's answers, but punctuated his questions with a noise that sounded like, Wrote poetry, did he? Oh, yes. Mm. And had it printed in the papers. Mm-hmm. Suppose they paid you for that kind of thing? Not much, eh? No, no, suppose not. Mm-hmm. Poetry? Mm. Bit difficult, that must be, getting the lines the same length and all that. Mm-hmm. Write anything else? Stories, so forth? Mm? Oh, yes, very interesting. Mm-hmm. Then, without further questions, he promoted Gordon to a special post as secretary, in effect apprentice, to Mr. Clue, the New Albion's head copywriter. Like every other advertising agency, the New Albion was constantly in search of copywriters with a touch of imagination. It is a curious fact, but it is much easier to find competent draftsmen than to find people who can think of slogans like QT Sauce Keeps Hubby Smiling, and Are You a Highbrow? Dandruff is the reason. Gordon's wages were not raised for the moment, but the firm had their eye on him. With luck, he might be a full-fledged copywriter in a year's time. It was an unmistakable chance to make good. For 6 months he was working with Mr. Clue. Mr. Clue was a harassed man of about 40, with wiry hair into which he often plunged his fingers. He worked in a stuffy little office, whose walls were entirely papered with his past triumphs in the form of posters. He took Gordon under his wing in a friendly way, showed him the ropes, and was even ready to listen to his suggestions. At that time, they were working on a line of magazine ads for April Dew, the great new deodorant which the Queen of Sheba Toilet Requisites Company, this was Flaxman's firm, curiously enough, were putting on the market. Gordon started on the job with secret loathing. But now there was a quite unexpected development. It was that Gordon showed, almost from the start, a remarkable talent for copywriting. He could compose an ad as though he had been born to it. The vivid phrase that sticks and rankles, the neat little para that packs a world of lies into 100 words, they came to him almost unsought. He had always had a gift for words, but this was the first time he had used it successfully. Mr. Clue thought him very promising. Gordon watched his own development, first with surprise, then with amusement, and finally with a kind of horror. This, then, was what he was coming to. Writing lies to tickle the money out of fools' pockets. There was a beastly irony, too, in the fact that he who wanted to be a writer should score his sole success in writing ads for deodorants. However, that was less unusual than he imagined. Most copywriters, they say, are novelists, manqués. Or is it the other way about? The Queen of Sheba were very pleased with their ads. Mr. Erskine also was pleased. Gordon's wages were raised by 10 shillings a week, and it was now that Gordon grew frightened. Money was getting him after all. He was sliding down, down into the money sty. A little more, and he would be stuck in it for life. It is queer how these things happen. You set your face against success. You swear never to make good. You honestly believe that you couldn't make good even if you wanted to, and then something happens along, some mere chance, and you find yourself making good almost automatically. He saw that now or never was the time to escape. He had got to get out of it, out of the money world, irrevocably, before he was too far involved. But this time he wasn't going to be starved into submission. He went to Ravelston and asked his help. He told him that he wanted some kind of job. Not a good job, but a job that would keep his body without wholly buying his soul. Ravelston understood perfectly. The distinction between a job and a good job did not have to be explained to him, nor did he point out to Gordon the folly of what he was doing. That was the great thing about Ravelston. He could always see another person's point of view. It was having money that did it, no doubt, for the rich can afford to be intelligent. Moreover, being rich himself, he could find jobs for other people. After only a fortnight, he told Gordon of something that might suit him, and Mr. McKechnie, a rather dilapidated second-hand bookseller with whom Ravelston dealt occasionally, was looking for an assistant. He did not want a trained assistant who would expect full wages. He wanted somebody who looked like a gentleman and could talk about books, somebody to impress the more bookish customers. It was the very reverse of a good job. The hours were long, the pay was wretched, £2 a week, and there was no chance of advancement. It was a blind alley job. And, of course, a blind alley job was the very thing Gordon was looking for. He went and saw Mr. McKechnie, a sleepy, benign old Scotchman with a red nose and a white beard stained by snuff, and was taken on without demur. At this time, too, his volume of poems, Mice, was going to press. The seventh publisher to whom he had sent it had accepted it. Gordon did not know that this was Ravelston's doing. Ravelston was a personal friend of the publisher. He was always arranging this kind of thing, stealthily, for obscure poets. Gordon thought the future was opening before him. He was a made man, or, by Smilesian aspidistral standards, unmade. He gave them a month's notice at the office. It was a painful business altogether. Julia, of course, was more distressed than ever at this second abandonment of a good job. By this time, Gordon had got to know Rosemary. She did not try to prevent him from throwing up his job. It was against her code to interfere. You've got to live your own life, was always her attitude. But she did not in the least understand why he was doing it. The thing that most upset him, curiously enough, was his interview with Mr. Erskine. Mr. Erskine was genuinely kind. He did not want Gordon to leave the firm, and said so frankly. With a sort of elephantine politeness, he refrained from calling Gordon a young fool. He did, however, ask him why he was leaving. Somehow, Gordon could not bring himself to avoid answering, or to say, the only thing Mr. Erskine would have understood, that he was going after a better-paid job. He blurted out shamefacedly that he didn't think business suited him, and that he wanted to go in for writing. Mr. Erskine was non-committal. Writing, eh? Much money in that sort of thing nowadays? Not much, eh? No, I suppose not. Gordon, feeling and looking ridiculous, mumbled that he had got a book just coming out. A book of poems, he added, with difficulty in pronouncing the word. Mr. Erskine regarded him sidelong before remarking, "Poetry, Poetry? Make a living out of that sort of thing, do you think?" "Well, not a living exactly, but it would help." "Well, you know best, I expect. If you want a job any time, come back to us. I dare say we could find room for you. We can do with your sort here, don't forget." Gordon left with a hateful feeling of having behaved perversely and ungratefully. But he had got to do it. He had got to get out of the money world. It was queer. All over England, young men were eating their hearts out for lack of jobs, and here was he, Gordon, to whom the very word job was faintly nauseous, having jobs thrust unwanted upon him. It was an example of the fact that you can get anything in this world if you genuinely don't want it. Moreover, Mr. Erskine's words stuck in his mind. Probably he had meant what he said. Probably there would be a job waiting for Gordon if he chose to go back. So his boats were only half burned. The New Albion was a doom before him as well as behind. But how happy he had been, just at first, in Mr. McKechnie's bookshop. For a little while, a very little while, he had the illusion of being really out of the money world. Of course, the book trade was a swindle, like all other trades, but how different a swindle. Here was no hustling and making good, no gutter crawling, no go-getter could put up for 10 minutes with the stagnant air of the book trade. As for the work, it was very simple. It was mainly a question of being in the shop 10 hours a day. Mr. McKechnie wasn't a bad old stick. He was a Scotchman, of course, but Scottish is as Scottish does. At any rate, he was reasonably free from avarice. His most distinctive trait seemed to be laziness. He was also a teetotaler and belonged to some non-conformist sect or other, but this did not affect Gordon. Gordon had been at the shop about a month when Mice was published. No less than 13 papers reviewed it, and the Times Lit Sup said that it showed exceptional promise. It was not till months later that he realized what a hopeless failure Mice had really been. And it was only now, when he was down to £2 a week and had practically cut himself off from the prospect of earning more, that he grasped the real nature of the battle he was fighting. The devil of it is that the glow of renunciation never lasts. Life on £2 a week ceases to be a heroic gesture and becomes a dingy habit. Failure is as great a swindle as success. He had thrown up his good job and renounced good jobs forever. Well, that was necessary. He did not want to go back on it. But it was no use pretending that because his poverty was self-imposed, he had escaped the ills that poverty drags in its train. It was not a question of hardship. You don't suffer real physical hardship on £2 a week, and if you did, it wouldn't matter. It is in the brain and the soul that lack of money damages you. Mental deadness, spiritual squalor, they seem to descend upon you inescapably when your income drops below a certain point. Faith, hope, money. Only a saint could have the first two without having the third. He was growing more mature. 27, 28, 29. He had reached the age when the future ceases to be a rosy blur and becomes actual and menacing. The spectacle of his surviving relatives depressed him more and more. As he grew older, he felt himself more akin to them. That was the way he was going. A few years more and he would be like that, just like that. He felt this even with Julia, whom he saw oftener than his uncle and aunt. In spite of various resolves never to do it again, he still borrowed money off Julia periodically. Julia's hair was greying fast. There was a deep line scored down each of her thin red cheeks. She had settled her life into a routine in which she was not unhappy. There was her work at the shop, her sewing at nights in her Earl's Court bed sitting room, second floor back, £9 a week unfurnished, her occasional foregatherings with spinster friends as lonely as herself. It was the typical submerged life of the penniless, unmarried woman. She accepted it, hardly realizing that her destiny could ever have been different. Yet in her way she suffered more for Gordon than for herself. The gradual decay of the family, the way they had died off and left nothing behind, was a sort of tragedy in her mind. Money. Money. None of us ever seems to make any money, was her perpetual lament. And of them all, Gordon alone had had the chance to make money, and Gordon had chosen not to. He was sinking, effortless, into the same rut of poverty as the others. After the first row was over, she was too decent to go for him again because he had thrown up his job at the New Albion. But his motives were quite meaningless to her. In her wordless, feminine way, she knew that the sin against money is the ultimate sin. And as for Aunt Angela and Uncle Walter, oh dear, what a couple. It made Gordon feel 10 years older every time he looked at them. Uncle Walter, for example. Uncle Walter was very depressing. He was 67, and what with his various agencies and the dwindling remnants of his patrimony, his income might have been nearly £3 a week. He had a tiny little cabin of an office off Cursitor Street, and he lived in a very cheap boarding house in Holland Park. That was quite according to precedent. All the Comstock men drifted naturally into boarding houses. When you looked at poor old uncle, with his large, tremulous belly, his bronchitic voice, his broad, pale, timidly pompous face, rather like Sargent's portrait of Henry James, his entirely hairless head, his pale, pouchy eyes, and his ever-drooping moustache, to which he tried vainly to give an upward twirl, when you looked at him, you found it totally impossible to believe that he had ever been young. Was it conceivable that such a being had ever felt life tingle in his veins? Had he ever climbed a tree, taken a header off a springboard, or been in love? Had he ever had a brain in working order? Even back in the early 1990s, when he was arithmetically young, had he ever made any kind of stab at life? A few furtive, half-hearted frolics, perhaps. A few whiskies in dull bars, a visit or two to the Empire Promenade, a little whoring on the QT, the sort of dingy, drabby fornications that you can imagine happening between Egyptian mummies after the museum is closed for the night. And after that, the long, long, quiet years of business failure, loneliness, and stagnation in godless boarding houses. And yet Uncle, in his old age, was probably not unhappy. He had one hobby of never failing interest, and that was his diseases. He suffered, by his own account, from every disease in the medical dictionary, and was never weary of talking about them. Indeed, it seemed to Gordon that none of the people in his uncle's boarding house, he had been there occasionally, ever did talk about anything except their diseases. All over the darkish drawing room, aging, discoloured people sat about in couples discussing symptoms. Their conversation was like the dripping of stalactite to stalagmite. Drip, drip. "How is your lumbago?" says stalactite to stalagmite. "I find my crucian salts are doing me good," says stalagmite to stalactite. Drip, drip, drip. And then there was Aunt Angela, age 69. Gordon tried not even to think of Aunt Angela oftener than he could help. Poor, dear, good, kind, depressing Aunt Angela. Poor, shriveled, parchment-yellow, skin-and-bone Aunt Angela. There in her miserable little semi-detached house in Highgate, Briarbrae, its name was, there in her palace in the northern mountains, there dwelleth she, Angela, the ever-virgin, of whom no man, either living or among the shades, can say truly that upon her lips he hath pressed the dear caresses of a lover. All alone she dwelleth, and all day long she fareth to and fro, and in her hands the feather-mop, fashioned from the tail-feathers of the contumacious turkey, and with it she polisheth the dark-leaved aspidistras, and flicketh the hated dust from the resplendent, never-to-be-used Crown Derby china tea-service. And ever and anon she comforteth her dear heart with draughts of the dark brown tea, both flowery orange and pekoe points, which the small-bearded sons of Coromandel have ferried to her across the wine-dark sea. Poor, dear, good, kind, but on the whole unlovable Aunt Angela. Her annuity was £98 a year, 38 bob a week, but she retained the middle-class habit of thinking of her income as a yearly and not a weekly thing, and out of that, 12 and sixpence a week went on house rates. She would probably have starved occasionally if Julia had not smuggled her packets of cakes and bread and butter from the shop, always, of course, presented as just a few little things that it seemed a pity to throw away, with the solemn pretense that Aunt Angela didn't really need them. Yet she too had her pleasures, poor old auntie. She had become a great novel reader in her old age, the public library being only 10 minutes' walk from Briarbrae. During his lifetime, on some whim or other, Grandpa Comstock had forbidden his daughters to read novels. Consequently, having only begun to read novels in 1902, Aunt Angela was always a couple of decades behind the current mode in fiction. But she plodded along in the rear, faint yet pursuing. In the 1900s, she was still reading Rhoda Broughton and Mrs. Henry Wood. In the war years, she discovered Hal Caine and Mrs. Humphrey Ward. In the 1920s, she was reading Silas Hocking and H. Seton Merriman. And by the 1930s, she had almost, but not quite, caught up with W.B. Maxwell and William J. Locke. Further, she would never get. As for the post-war novelists, she had heard of them afar off with their immorality and their blasphemies and their devastating cleverness, but she would never live to read them. Walpole we know, and Hitchens we read, but Hemingway, who are you? Well, this was 1934, and that was what was left of the Comstock family. Uncle Walter, with his agencies and his diseases. Aunt Angela, dusting the Crown Derby china tea service in Briarbrae. Aunt Charlotte, still preserving a vague vegetable existence in the Mendel home. Julia, working a 72-hour week and doing her sewing at nights by the tiny gas fire in her bed sitting room. Gordon, nearly 30, earning £2 a week in a fool's job and struggling as the sole demonstrable object of his existence with a dreadful book that never got any further. Possibly there were some other, more distantly related Comstocks, for Grandpa Comstock had been one of a family of 12, but if any survived, they had grown rich and lost touch with their poor relations, for money is thicker than blood. As for Gordon's branch of the family, the combined income of the five of them, allowing for the lump sum that had been paid down when Aunt Charlotte entered the mental home, might have been 600 a year. Their combined ages were 263 years. None of them had ever been out of England, fought in war, been in prison, ridden a horse, travelled in an aeroplane, got married, or given birth to a child. There seemed no reason why they should not continue in the same style until they died. Year in, year out, nothing ever happened in the Comstock family.